Chief Justice throws shade at the president. Trump endorses political murder for profit. And New Yorkers prepare for the big chill. Is NYCHA ready? With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo for the WBAIEV News for Wednesday, November 21st, 2018. Chief Justice John Roberts issued a rare rebuke to President Donald Trump on Wednesday, defending the independent judiciary and contradicting Trump's latest attack on a federal judge. Roberts said in a statement, "We do not have Obama judges or Trump judges, Bush judges or Clinton judges. What we have is an extraordinary group of dedicated judges doing their level best to do equal right to those appearing before them," adding that independent judiciary is something we should all be thankful for. The comments came less than 24 hours after Trump attacked a ruling against his latest asylum policy, calling the decision a disgrace.
"Every case that gets filed in the Ninth Circuit, we get beaten, and then we end up having to go to the Supreme Court. People should not be allowed to immediately run to this very friendly circuit and file their case."
Trump's latest outburst came after federal district judge John Tiger halted enforcement of the Trump administration's new asylum policy. Tiger, the son of legendary defense lawyer Michael Tiger, sits on the Ninth Circuit Court covering the San Francisco Bay Area. It might be added that Michael Tiger represented Lynn Stewart here in New York. Trump's order would bar those who cross the southern border from seeking asylum in the United States unless they come into the country at a port of entry. Trump's comments came as the president was questioned on his way to the presidential helicopter, a format where the president seems most comfortable. On Monday, the White House stepped back from its move to deprive CNN reporter Jim Acosta of his press credentials. CNN had sued the White House after an incident where the president had tried to avoid answering a line of questions from Acosta. In a highly unusual step, the administration used the occasion to lay down a set of formal rules governing reporters' behavior at future White House news conferences. Among the guidelines was a restriction of one question per reporter, with follow-ups allowed at the discretion of the president or the White House official at the lectern. Failure to abide, the administration warned, may result in suspension or revocation of the journalist's hard pass. Although White House officials attempted to blame Acosta for the flap, Trump often encourages a free-for-all atmosphere at news conferences. He's also whipped up his supporters to interfere with and threaten reporters at public events. The president also weighed in on the simmering controversy over the murder of Washington Post reporter Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi embassy in Istanbul last month. Trump defied a growing body of evidence by claiming that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's culpability for the killing might never be known.
"They didn't make a determination. And it's just like I said, I think it was very, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. They did not make that assessment. The CIA has looked at it. They've studied it a lot. They have nothing definitive. And the fact is, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. If you look at Iran, what they've done, they've been a bad actor. You look at what's happening in Syria with Assad, with hundreds of thousands of people killed. We are with Saudi Arabia. We're staying with Saudi Arabia. And by the way, just so everybody, I have no business whatsoever with Saudi Arabia. Couldn't care less."
Trump's statement, which aides say reflect his deeply held views, came only days after the CIA concluded that the Crown Prince, a close ally of the White House, had authorized the killing of Khashoggi. The president went on to justify his views by illustrating the vast amount of military purchases from U.S. arms manufacturers that are made by the Saudi government.
No. This is about America first. They're paying us $400 billion plus to purchase and invest in our country. That's probably the biggest amount ever paid to the United States.
The New York Times wrote today that Trump's off-the-cuff observations were a stark distillation of the Trump worldview, remorselessly transactional, heedless of the facts, determined to put America's interests first, and founded on a theory of moral equivalence. Trump also drew outrage from members of Congress and human rights activists. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, said in a statement, "The behavior of the Crown Prince in multiple ways has shown disrespect for the relationship and made him, in my view, beyond toxic." Iran's foreign minister alluded to Trump's unfounded assertion that California could have avoided its calamitous wildfires by adopting Finland's practice of clearing debris from the forest floor. The foreign minister said in a tweet, "Perhaps we're also responsible for the California fires because we didn't help rake the forests, just like the Finns do." Trump's close alignment with the Saudi crown prince is in line with his son-in-law Jared Kushner and the hawks of the administration who are building a coalition against Iran together with Israel and the other Gulf states. But at least one business organization isn't towing the line. On Monday, the home renting company Airbnb announced it would remove listings in Jewish settlements in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. The move prompted the Israeli government to meet with the U.S. to plan a response. Israeli settlements in the occupied territory are considered illegal by most of the world. Palestinians say the settlements are obstacles to their goal of establishing an independent state. On its own website, Airbnb said many in the global community have stated that companies should not be doing business in the occupied territories because they believe companies should not profit on lands where people have been displaced. The company stated that it would remove the approximately 200 listings in Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank that are at the core of the dispute between Israelis and Palestinians. Airbnb's move came on the eve of the publication of a report by Human Rights Watch. The 65-page report titled Bed and Breakfast on Stolen Land, Tourist Rental Listings in West Bank Settlements, traces the status of the land on which rental properties were built. Sarah Sadoun is a researcher working on the effect of businesses on human rights. She says Airbnb was renting homes built on land that was illegally seized by Israel.
What we found was that companies like Airbnb and Booking.com were listing properties for rent in settlements where the underlying property was seized unlawfully by Israel. And in fact, in some cases, we're able to identify the Palestinian owners of this land who are under Israeli law not even allowed to enter settlements, right? So they cannot rent, although they're the lawful owner of this land, they cannot rent this Airbnb property. Human Rights Watch partnered with an Israeli organization called Kerem Navot, which has access to the status of the underlying land in the West Bank. And so we were able to actually match the listings to what the land status was. And we found that some cases of properties on private Palestinian land or in settlements that are not even legal under Israeli law. Although I should emphasize that regardless of whether it's private or public land or the settlement is considered legal by Israel, it all violates the international law on occupation.
Why was this report written?
Well, the idea was to, firstly, to inform Airbnb and to inform others. We operate on an investigate, expose, change paradigm. So we make these investigations. We assume that by putting this information out there in the public domain, we'll be able to effectuate change, and that's exactly what happened in this case. We were able, through 2 years of conversation with Airbnb, to inform them really of what for them was a topic that they had very little expertise on, as you can imagine, and what the stakes were. And in fact, they used this information as part of broader information gathering exercise to ultimately determine that we were right, that they should not be listing these properties because it violated their responsibilities under human rights responsibilities, but also their company ethics policy.
They obviously yesterday or earlier this week, they decided to withdraw all their listings.
Yeah, well, I mean, it still remains to be seen how they implement this policy change. There are questions how they're going to distinguish between settlements and Palestinian areas and whether or not East Jerusalem will be included in the policy change. So you would have to speak to Airbnb as to exactly how they are going to implement it.
Sadoun says Israel's settlements on the West Bank are a violation of laws designed to protect people who are the victims of war.
Human Rights Watch has been doing research around abuses in the West Bank for a very long time, both human rights abuses, documenting the highly discriminatory system that exists that separates between Palestinians and Israelis legally and practically. But it's also, we've also been documenting violations of the laws of occupation. The settlement project violates the international humanitarian law, as does the seizure of natural resources, these natural resources for Israel's economic benefit. And we've been doing advocacy on these issues, and as you can imagine, not getting very far. But in doing this research, we realized that a big part of what's sustaining these abuses is the international business community, because even if it's a small part of the business's overall activity, this is what allows settlements to function. The ability to use sites like Airbnb to rent out homes, the ability to have cell phone service and access to cement for building and building materials and real estate brokers, banks, financing. This is what basically enables this violation to continue. and this contravenes businesses' responsibilities.
What is human rights law? Why does a country have to follow human rights law?
There are actually two very important bodies of law at stake here. The first is human rights, which are covenants that almost every country in the world has signed that dictate how a government can treat people. You can't subject people to unfair trial. You have to give people the right to freedom of expression. You can't discriminate. These are basic human rights that every person has just by virtue of being born. And then there's a separate body of law, which is the laws of war and occupation, most of which comes from after the Second World War, where they tried to devise a body of law that would both minimize civilian harm during war, but also discourage going to war in the first place. And a big part of that was not being able to change your borders or extract economic benefit from the land that you conquer during war in order to basically take away major incentive for going to war in the first place, which is exactly why settlements are illegal. You cannot move your civilian population into occupied territory because that land doesn't belong to you. You hold it in protection, in stewardship, until a peace treaty is eventually reached. And so by not only moving settlers into the West Bank, but also making that area an integral part of the Israeli economy, it is violating these laws. But on top of that, it's also violating human rights law because settlers are not equal to Palestinians. If a settler and a Palestinian get into a fight and both are arrested, one is subject to civilian law. Settlers are subject to Israeli civilian law, and Palestinians are subject to Israeli military law. They also have completely different access to things like building permits, where Palestinians get like in the single digits building permits in the part of West Bank under immediate Israeli control, whereas settlers get thousands. They have different allotments of water. I mean, it affects literally every aspect of their lives. The two-tiered system, legally, structurally, you know, in terms of access to public goods, in every single way, it is a segregated system. And so when businesses are contributing to the sustainability of settlements, they're not only contributing to this violation of the laws of occupation, but they're also contributing inevitably to these human rights abuses because there's no way around them. They're written into the very fact of life in the West Bank.
Sadoun, who has lived in Israel for years, says the relationship in the West Bank is so one-sided against the Palestinians, the settlers should not be complaining about being shunned by Airbnb.
I think the Israeli reaction has been predictable, claiming that this is somehow unfair or anti-Semitic, or, I mean, claims that this is somehow discriminatory against settlers is so outrageous given the levels of discrimination against Palestinians in the West Bank that benefit settlers. And to hear settlers complain that they are the victims of discrimination when they are literally subject to a different and much fairer legal set of laws than Palestinians, where they have access to water, to infrastructure, to building permits, to education, to travel, to so many things that Palestinians are systematically denied, which would be outrageous if it happened anywhere in the world to have a two-tiered system like this. But when you remember that this is actually occupied territory that is supposed to be, Israel is supposed to ensure the benefit goes to Palestinians and not for its own civilian or economic benefit, then it becomes doubly outrageous. And so, I mean, that's what their reaction has been. It's predictable, but it's wrong.
Meanwhile, Israeli Cabinet Minister Gilad Erdan called for a boycott of Airbnb and promoted one of its rivals on Wednesday. Erdan said all those who support Israel and oppose discriminatory boycotts, they should cease using Airbnb and turn to other services. Airbnb lists over 20,000 hosts in the Jewish state, a popular tourist destination. And back in New York City, the United States Post Office, located at 99 McCombs Place in Harlem, got a new name today after a group of African-American fighter pilots who made history during World War II. WBAI's Alana Levinson has the story.
The Tuskegee Airmen, a group of black pilots who fought in World War II, have been honored in film over the years.
Targets coming up just ahead, over that ridge. We gotta knock out the German supply train, it's the time.
First, back in 1995, then again in the 2012 drama Red Tails. The film tells how black pilots overcame opposition to become one of the finest fighter groups in World War II. A museum in Michigan also celebrates the fighters, and now Harlem has paid tribute to the war heroes. Wilfred DeFore is now 100 years old. He is one of the remaining Tuskegee Airmen. After his Air Force service in World War II, he worked for the U.S. Postal Service for decades. This week, he was honored at a renaming ceremony.
Mr. DeFore, you have celebrated your 100th year.
Assemblywoman Inez Dickens recognized him both for his service in the Air Force and also for his work fighting for Harlem residents to have access to affordable housing.
You not only lived that 100 years, you worked those years, not only for yourself, but for the rest of us, so that we would have shelter, so that we would know from what we come and whose shoulders we stand on. And Mr. DeFore, you, we stand on your shoulders.
New York City officials and residents gathered to rename the United States Post Office on Macomb's Place, now called the Tuskegee Airmen Post Office Building. Speakers noted the importance the name change has in highlighting the accomplishments of people of color. Assemblyman Al Taylor says the renaming speaks to Harlem's legacy of fighting for racial justice.
But I want to talk to the heart of what it takes to get what you did accomplished. I want to talk about the heart of what it takes to keep us alive. And this is a rock or a stone that says no matter what comes, I'm going to say hell or high water, they will know this post office is connected to the service rendered by those brave men that went out and did what nobody else wanted to do. And they didn't do it because they were pushed to do it. They fought to do it because they were trained to do it. And they were sitting on the sideline and said, hey, we are qualified to do the work. Yeah, let us go perform. Yeah, yeah, and when you talk about the heart, that's been the heart of our community, part of this country from day one.
Yeah.
See, those things, when you've been marginalized, you can still get up. When you've been slapped and said you can't vote, you still get up. And when they can't give you the heat and hot water that you need, you can still get up and perform.
New York Representative Adriano Espaillat introduced the bill to have the name changed last November, and in July, it became law. He said the Tuskegee Airmen were pioneers in their fight against segregation.
They were really known for breaking the racial barriers in the military and were active in fighting against Jim Crow in the South. Renaming this post office facility after the Tuskegee Airmen is a fitting tribute to the honor their memory and contributions to this country has been.
Jeffrey Eaton is the first vice president for the NAACP New York State Conference. He says he thinks symbolic changes like this one are connected to broader policy change.
Because we all struggle together to find the American pie for people. And then we're going through a time right now, an epic time, where we did have a dress rehearsal to change the course of this country and put it on the right course. And having this post office named Tuskegee Airmen tells us how we need to really do more of that so that our young children, the people who live in the neighborhood and around here, will understand what the history is all about.
And now the Tuskegee Airmen Post Office Building becomes another symbol of Harlem pride. Alana Levinson, WBAI News, New York.
And that's the Tuskegee Airmen. Women won the right to vote in the United States in 1920 after the passage of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. A year later, the Equal Rights Amendment was introduced to guarantee equal political rights to all women. After several attempts, it fell three states short of two-thirds necessary for ratification. But the ERA is still on the agenda for some women. Jessica Brockington has the story.
In the spirit of Brooklyn's Shirley Chisholm and Manhattan's Bella Abzug, Congressmember Carolyn Maloney, who represents parts of Queens, Brooklyn, and Manhattan, has been pushing the Equal Rights Amendment since she was first elected to the House. That was back in 1992. She has introduced the amendment in Congress 11 times. She says the Kavanaugh hearing inspired her to lean into the fight even harder in the upcoming session.
Well, I think that watching the Kavanaugh hearings it was really very disturbing to me that they were putting a person on the court who was in the, quote, pathway of Scalia, same philosophy.
Maloney spoke at a recent town hall on women's issues in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. She is highly critical of former conservative Supreme Court Justice Scalia, who worked to prevent passage of the ERA.
Well, Scalia's come out and said women are not in the Constitution, and there's no guarantee to protect them from discrimination. I think women should be in the Constitution and should be protected from discrimination. An Equal Rights Amendment would do that.
The ERA is surprisingly simple. It was first written in 1923 by suffragists like Alice Paul. It says equal rights shall not be denied on account of sex. It gives Congress and individual states the power to enforce the amendment, and it says that it'll take effect 2 years after it's approved by the states. Maloney told the crowd in Greenpoint that the Constitution protects people from discrimination based on their race and sexual orientation, but not on gender. When the ERA was introduced in the 2014-2015 Congress, the language had been changed. A new sentence was added. Women shall have equal rights in the United States and every place subject to its jurisdiction. If this amendment is ratified by the states, it'll be the only place in the U.S. Constitution where women are named. As simple as it is, the ERA has been fought against bitterly over the years. Working women were concerned in the 1970s that they would lose legal protections if they were treated the same as men in the workplace. People were also afraid it would open the door for women into the military. Maloney says these things aren't issues anymore. She points to Mikey Sherrill, the newly elected congressmember from New Jersey who was a Navy combat pilot. As Maloney told Glamour magazine last June, women are half the population, and yet the only right we are guaranteed in the Constitution is the right to vote. She said the ERA is the legal bedrock from which we can fight for and win equal pay for equal work, end sexual harassment and assault, and end gender discrimination. The Equal Rights Amendment has come close. It was passed by the House in 1971, and in 1972 it passed the Senate. Of the 535 members of Congress at the time, only 15 were women. These were the days of Bella Abzug, Shirley Chisholm, and Patsy Mink. In that same year, 1972, 35 states approved it, but by law it needed to be approved by 38 states, a two-thirds majority, in order to be added to the Constitution, and it was given a time limit. The men in Congress wanted the ERA ratified within 10 years. And then, on March 22, 2017, shortly after Donald Trump took office, and a full 45 years after Congress passed the ERA and the last state had ratified, Nevada stepped up to become the 36th state to ratify. And in May 2018, Illinois became 37. Right now, Virginia is poised to become the needed 38th state. Maloney credits the Me Too and Time's Up movements, and she's been actively campaigning in Virginia.
Just last weekend, I was in Virginia. We had a van that we were going all over the place trying to get support to ratify it. I was with numerous legislators from the state senate and from the assembly, and they are dedicated. They are charged. They think they can do it, and I believe they're going to do it. I'm going to go down for the opening session of the Virginia legislature and speak to legislators and lobby for it with them.
But even if Virginia comes through and 38 states approve the amendment, Maloney thinks the ERA is in for another battle. That 10-year time limit has long passed.
So we are claiming that it's now ratified. It'll go to the Supreme Court. If they disagree with us because of the time limit or whatever, then we intend to pass legislation in Congress that will first say that there is no time limit, and then secondly just go back and start the whole process again. Pass the Equal Rights Amendment again, but we're not going to give up.
Over 100 women were elected to Congress in the 2018 midterm elections. Women will hold nearly 20% of the seats in 2019. Maloney says people have called it the blue wave. She's calling it the pink wave, and she says it's time to get it done. Jessica Brockington, WBAI News, New York.
And finally, Mayor de Blasio and other elected officials last month touted major heating improvements at NYCHA facilities as they toured a public housing building on the Lower East Side. Tenants at one of those buildings say they have been without heat and hot water since the snowstorm last Thursday. City Councilwoman Carlina Rivera, who represents the area, said unfortunately this is all too common a problem when it comes to NYCHA tenants and the hundreds of thousands of people who live in public housing. After Hurricane Sandy, tenants at the new building were left with an emergency replacement boiler. A new boiler was installed last year, but tenants in approximately 20 apartments living at 99 Avenue C say their new boiler isn't working to bring heat and hot water to their homes since the storm. They're not the only NYCHA residents without heat and hot water. There are an estimated 6,366 NYCHA tenants throughout the city dealing with the same problem. According to an online service interruption tracker, another 3,875 had the same issue due to planned work. Residents dealing with similar problems are encouraged to report these issues via the My NYCHA app or by calling the Customer Contact Center at 718-707-7771. That's 718-707-7771. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, November 21st, 2018. The news was produced with Ilana Levinson and Jessica Brockington. It was engineered by Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo in New York.